Yeah, Glenn DePeggio. Really, Glenn Forrest DePeggio. Please spell that with two N's. 16441 130th Avenue, Nunica, for the time being. Okay.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning.
Born July 6, 1919. Born July 6, 1919 in Hatton Hospital, which no longer exists in the city of Grand Haven.
Where was Hatton?
Hatton Hospital is on 5th Street. That's an interesting thing, too. Do you remember that 5th Street becomes Sheldon Road, becomes Lakeshore Drive? You can drive on three different streets without changing direction. Anyway, Hatton Hospital was on 5th Street between Franklin Street and Clinton Street, and it's right where the Presbyterian Church is now. It was a huge wooden frame building, and it was three stories high. And where I lived on 521 Clinton was around the corner, and that's also the Presbyterian's parking lot. And when they finished operating, they operated in those days with ether. And when they, there's a Kleenex right over there. When they finished operating up on that third floor there, they would open up all the windows, and the ether smell would come over to as far as our house, which is a half a block away. No, you could just smell the ether when they finished an operation. But I was born there. I lived it on 521. Now, 521 was in between 5th Street and 6th Street. And it's now the Presbyterian Church's parking lot. I lived across the street from Vin's, V-Y-N, that had the Vin Trucking Company in those days. And I grew up with John Vin, who's now dead. His mother was Joyce Vin. She took us out to the lake, and we had all wonderful time. And also across the street was Paul Johnson of, you know, the JSJ Corporation now. That's why I put his name down. I grew up with him, went to school with him. And then a little bit up is was the next one to him was Irene and Hart Junker, and their son was Al. And they're going to have a reunion or something, I saw in the paper. I would have liked to. I forgot where that's going to be. I would like to meet them again. But Mary Ann and Al, I grew up with them also. And they were across the street. Our house was 521. Paul Johnson's was 520. And I think the Yonkers was 522. Now, the house is still there. They're big white houses. The Johnson house is still there. And when I first started recognizing things, that section of street in between 5th and 6th was not paved. There was a dirt road. And I remember big central school that was up there, the one that burned. And I remember the iceman coming down. We would get on the back, and it was a horse-drawn ice truck. We would climb up on the back and get ice, you know. And we used to play in the backyards. We would, Joyce was an outdoor woman. Very, how do you put that? She was
into nature, or
no, into children and outgoing. She was part. She was not a woman of the times who stayed in the house and was very much in the church circles and everything else. She smoked cigarettes. She drove a car. She drove the car 60 miles an hour. She would go fast in the streets. She played Run Sheep Run with the kids, you know, and played games with us. Rode a bicycle. No, and we're talking about, I was born in 1919. We're talking 1929.
Wow.
There.
Wow.
Uninhibited? Is that the word?
Yeah, it sounds good.
All right,
like
uninhibited. So she's uninhibited.
What did neighbors think of her?
Not much. Oh, my mother used to talk about Joyce, outrageous, and outlandish, you know. Well, she's getting down. She's doing things like the kids. But that woman's still alive. She's almost 90. She's in Palo Alto, California now.
Okay.
Yeah. And she had a beautiful family. I can remember all of them. No. Well, anyway, in those days, the car ferries were still coming into town. And as you grew up and as a boy, you used to walk. See, my daddy worked for Mr. Laudert. And Mr. Laudert was a son of a lumber baron. And he's the one who actually started the Laudert Library. His son was willed all of the money, but he could only touch the interest. And when he died, the will stated that all of the money would be used for the Laudert Foundation. So there was William H., that was my dad's employer, and William R. And William H. lived in a house that was on the corner of Washington and 4th. And right now there's a gasoline station there. And if we only had had a historical society, the doggone house would still be there. It was a four-story house, brick. And magnificent high 12-foot ceilings. I was in the house several times with my dad. A complete wine cellar in the basement, an old-style furnace. And then you go on the main floor, and there were all of the dining areas, and he entertained a lot. And he would have his butler and his maid supplemented with another woman by the name of May Comerford, and another woman who I don't remember her name, but they would throw these dinner parties for the Hattons, the Harbecks, the Robins, and they would have pheasant under glass and all the crystal and the silverware and things. And of course my father was looked in on this and things. My father was his chauffeur, and in those days he was also a mechanic, because there were no, you couldn't just take your car to a garage.
Yeah.
I remember many times I would walk down to the garage. My dad would have that, the hood off of this, the Lincoln, and he would have the engine all apart, the parts laying all over everything, and he would be refinishing parts and putting it back together. And I remember one time,
was this in the late 20s?
About in there, yes, because I was still in I was in grade school at that time. I graduated from high school in 37. And 4 years before that's 34, so not 20s, hon. Late 20s and early 30s, yeah. Because in the 30s, we were hard up with the Depression. But anyway, to get back to my story, my father had the key to the wine cellar. And then, if you can imagine where 4th Street and Washington is, there was only about 5 blocks. And my dad never rode to work. He walked to work. We didn't have a car until, shoot, I remember us getting the first car. Fact is, I smashed up the first car. But he would drive for Mr. Laudert. And, oh, if you could only get back into the history of that thing. My father also, now there was a fire barn. Well, I think it's just parking now for the courthouse. But there was a fire barn. Now, which way would you say that Washington Street runs when going towards the river? It's on an angle, you know. But let's call it north, just for sake of a direction. And that way we'll be able to determine that 5th Street runs east and west. And if you were to remember way back, the fire barn, one of the fire barns, was on the corner of Washington and 5th, and it was on the northwest corner. And in it was an old LaFrance fire engine. And if that fire, there were two engines, But the LaFrance, my dad used to, after work from Mr. Lauder, he would go into that fire barn there, and he took 3 weeks to completely take down that big engine, pour the Babbitt for the bearings on the bottom, scrape them out by hand, and reassemble that engine. So those are the memories that I have of that time. I remember walking way down Washington Street to the other fire barn. There was one down there. And there was a pumper in that one. And I remember that Kitty Corner from Washington and 5th across the way over there was a school for girls.
Oh, the Ackley House?
Ackley House. I was in that Ackley House after it discontinued because all the windows were gone and there was still some plaster from statues that was laying around. And we used to take that plaster. It made good chalk. But that way I walked, and of course Central Park was still there. Well, I believe it just went out because the girls didn't want to go through a finishing school anymore. And I guess...
So was it kind of an after high school?
No, the girls, some of them actually stayed there and are live-in, and the other ones would come on a per diem basis. And it was a finishing school. I think they were teenagers. See, they were finishing school kind of thing. And that's all I remember because from hearsay, because the school was defunct when I first started knowing.
But it was still there.
And Washington Street was all bricks, all the way up and down, those red bricks up and down there. And we used to go down to the foot of Washington Street. And they would keep their rowboats there, and they would go out, right out into the river and go fishing. So, I guess to get on, what else? You ask a question now.
Can we turn the speaker on?
What the heck is it going? Well, I guess we can turn it off. Well... Yeah.
I wanted to... Okay.
Would you ask?
I wanted to go into about maybe your education.
Oh.
What schools you went to and teachers you remember.
Yep. Mrs. Soule. S-O-U-L. S-O-U-L-E. In fourth grade, I took it over again because I was writing with my left hand. She was a stinker. She came to the house. You will write with your right hand. And when I finished writing, I was writing upside down. Took the hand over the top. And that was in Central School, the one that burned. And living at 521 Clinton and having the school up there on between 6th and 7th, I had a half a block to go to school. And the school bell on the top would ring, and then it would toll. And about the time it started tolling, about the time I left the house. And up there it is. Yeah, I remember starting in the bottom. And all wood floors and things. And we were in the end of the school that was on the Franklin Street side. That's where. And we would go out. There were doors that led out onto a large playground there. We'd go out there and play, and then we graduated to we would walk up the steps for that, and we stayed in there, and for the middle classes, before we finally had freedom. We had no more playgrounds. We were able to go to high school, which was on 7th Street, which was on 7th Street there. That high school's gone. They tore that high school down. And there you were able to only attend the classes that you had, and the rest of the time it was yourself. You could walk around. You didn't have to be in school. You could go out and be outside.
Open campus.
Yeah. Just the fact that you did not have to... you weren't confined as much. You were given that responsibility. Okay. Mrs. Soule, when I was in that grade school, She came home and talked to my folks. And my dad said, he is born left-handed. He's going to be left-handed. Get off his back. If you don't, he didn't use those words because you don't say off his back in those days. But he said, if he is not learning, then keep him back a class. But he will learn. And I was a slow learner. And I was left-handed. So that's what I remember of those days. And in high school, of course, in those days, kids worked celery fields.
Excuse me, I'm vacuuming the floor and it's too noisy, you let me know.
How are we going to let you know? You won't hear.
Well, come up the steps and say,
I think it'll be fine.
Why don't you vacuum and then ask, you know, stop and then ask.
Okay.
All right.
Celery.
In the celery fields, I think they couldn't think I could handle it. My folks didn't think I could handle it either because I was a 95-pound weakling. Look at me now. Now that's going to be too loud, isn't it? There'll be a lot of background noise.
Yeah.
So we'll wait until she's... Well, anyway, we'll keep on with this part of it. She's going to do it anyway. Why don't you come on down and listen to the interview?
Okay, no, I'll guess the book.
All right. Was in band, you know. Mm-hmm. We had band in high school. There were 90 musicians in Mr. Richards' senior high school band. 90. I played the drums, snare drums. And, of course, when we had concerts, I played the timpani and the drums and everything else. But in those days, working in celery fields, I couldn't handle that. And while I was going to high school, then I used to deliver papers. And you make out pretty good. We had to do our own collections. But I would go down...
Did you still do the celery fields at the same time as the
No. They wouldn't. My dad said, no, you can't handle the celery fields.
Where were the celery fields?
Oh, celery fields that were the closest and the ones that they would work. There were Keefe's that's about where Robbins Road is now. There were celery fields there. But the one that was the most popular was on Fulton Street at Ferry. There were celery fields in there. Also, see, in those days, Beacon Boulevard didn't come right through the middle of town. Beacon Boulevard came through on a street, and I've forgotten the name of it, but the street is no longer there because it's now Beacon Boulevard. They moved a whole lot of houses out of there and everything else. But all down on the east side of Beacon, where Beacon Boulevard is now, and south of about Waverly Street, was what they used to call the celery flats. There were no houses there. That whole section of town, that's all houses now, was celery fields.
Wow.
And
I never knew that there was celery growing.
Oh, golly. We you could smell celery when they started cutting it almost everywhere you went. It's a most just a beautiful smell. Then I am going to get to that, but I, you know where you're going up Grand Avenue when you go out Sheldon Road and then go Grand Avenue and you go up that big sand hill as you're going out to the lake? On both sides of you are houses in there. There were no houses there. We used to go there when we were Boy Scouts and camp in just the middle of fields, just for an overnighter. Anyway, I would go down to Hostetter's and pick up the Morning Herald. And I would deliver that, and my route was in the Jackson Street area. Now, that whole section in there where they want to put in the new bridge and things like that, Jackson and 4th, 5th, 6th, and Jackson and Madison and those areas in there. I would deliver the Morning Herald in there. Then I would go and meet the train, because the train station is right there on 4th. And I would meet the train and I'd pick up all the Chicago papers. Not meet the train. As soon as I hear the train, I'd go there and the papers would be laying there. They'd left them, threw them up. I'd pick those up and take the ones that I had to deliver to all the downtown stores, and some of them up on Lake Avenue. Dr. Hook and a few of these people up there wanted that Wall Street Journal and things, you know. I would take those up there, riding my bike all over the place. And then I would go to school. And after school, I would go down, and at first it was the Balls, B-O-L. And they lived up across from the City Hall on Washington Street there. And they had the Muskegon Chronicle and the Grand Rapids Press. And for a while I delivered the Chronicle, I guess, and then for a while I delivered the Press. And then the people from the papers got a little bit and they said, you can't do that. So I think Hostetter's got the Chronicle, and Balls were able to still deliver the Press. Well, Hostetter offered another penny, so I went to work for Hostetter. Then I think I gave up one of those routes or whatever it was. Then Arnold Brock offered me a job.
Bakery?
In the bakery. And Arnie Brock...
What bakery was
it? It was Brock's Bakery. No. I had to go over there once, over to Spring Lake. But that was his dad. And he had started a bakery where... on Washington Street, well, I guess you call it Centertown. It isn't where the Cook's Hardware is, but it's on the corner of Washington and 7th, and along in that area there. Okay, if we're talking Washington goes north and south, it was south of 7th Street, about two blocks. It was north of Andre's, a little white building there, and that was a bakery. And some of the fondest memories of my life were working, going in there in the morning, 4 o'clock.
Wow.
And wrapping bread and having the drivers come in and start putting up their loads of Bismarcks and everything else. And you could eat anything that you wanted in the sweets. And I guess I did for a week or so. But most of the time it was wrapped bread. And then I would go down and pick up my papers and wrap those and then go to school.
Oh, wow.
So.
Weren't you a bit tired?
Yeah, that's why I wasn't a very good student. But after school...
Was that during the Depression?
Yeah, that was during the Depression.
So you really...
Honey, I'll tell you one thing. My dad worked for Mr. Lauder. And people were on the streets. Or they were dependent on church for handouts. Depending on relatives that had something to eat. We closed off one part of our house on Clinton Street there. That the big parlor that was kind of a wing, left the piano in there, took the rug and nailed it up to a big arch that was about 8 feet wide and 6 feet eight high, nailed that rug up in there all around the edges, and didn't use that room. And there was no reason to. We just were pretending, because he worked for Mr. Laudert for $35 a week. And he worked for him all during the Depression. Yep. Yes. And during that time, he bought the house next door. There were two houses on one lot, and the driveway was between. And that house was first owned by Simpson, and then Denherter bought it. And that was John Denherter. John Denherter was the county treasurer. And the old county house, which has also been torn down. And getting onto another section of this interview here, my opinions, I think that there should have been established a long time ago a heritage society that would have preserved all of these old buildings and things. No, not the courthouse. But I can't see the whole middle part of downtown Grand Haven becoming an asphalt paving lot. And just those historic houses... being And the loss of the Laudit House is depressing. Likewise, to jump ahead of where I am right now, just a minute of digression. When we thought of and designed the musical water fountain over there, we had visions of people coming to see the fountain, sitting on the grass there, and watching the fountain absolutely free of charge on the waterfront. Then the city fathers got into it and decided that we should have a stadium. Well, everybody's cooperative, and you wind up with an $80,000 stadium there, and then they wanted to charge. Well, when they wanted to charge, about five of us on the committee said, if you charge, we're done on the committee. You can find somebody else to do all the technical repairs and improvements and everything else, and they backed off.
That's how can you charge people?
Yep.
I mean, they just won't go in and pay for it. They'll just sit out in the grass.
Well, that's true, but we had designed the phone, and about $50,000 worth of money went into it from different industries. And one heck of a lot of night work that we spent. I was over there till 3 o'clock in the morning and working at Gardner Denver. And we did it because we wanted the city of people, the fathers of the people that live in Grand Haven, to enjoy something. Well, yeah, if they bring in their friends to look at it, fine. We certainly didn't have any mind that it was going to become a tourist town. It was for the people of the city of Grand Haven. And just one more minute of digression. Right now, you go down to the waterfront, and it's like walking in any other tourist trap on Mackinac Island or anything else. You can't enjoy the peace of the river because there are people, there are crowds. They have put up a monstrosity of a thing with looks like a sailboat down there to obstruct your view. They put the Coast Guard building right on the beautiful Coast Guard building across the way there. It's a landmark.
Someone's trying to buy it and turn it into
a
breakfast.
And I don't know if this should go in the record or not. It's a personal opinion. I think that everybody tries to create an empire. And I think that we have people in the city of Grand Haven that are trying to create an empire. And although their intentions are good, because they like their job and they're trying to create an empire, they are destroying the peaceful, tranquil, high quality education, low personnel, police force. We have, where we had before, you could walk up to the city manager and talk to him. Now there's personnel directors, assistant city managers, and all the rest. You can't get to the, it's getting so high. The police force has, there used to be five people in the police force. There was no crime. Nobody locked their doors, nothing. And they say, all right, more people, more industry. Let's, all this industry in here, this helps us. They're going to pay the taxes. I don't know of a single person in Grand Haven that has not had their property assessed and reassessed and reassessed, and their taxes are not any lower. Their taxes are way high. Crime rate is up. You can't drive through the streets. You can't go out and sit on the bank and without having a dozen people walking in front of you all the time, you know? So that's just
we're
personal.
What we're attracted to is now being destroyed.
What we're becoming is a Saugatuck or a Mackinac Island or the Fudge City and things. And for some people, well, that's great. And maybe for you, for your generation, you like the excitement and all. But I don't know. I think that with a lot of people comes a lot of problems.
Not that great for my generation either.
Oh, okay.
Going to Grand Haven is not fun for me.
Huh?
You know, it's not. I like to go to the beach and swim, but now it's awful. It's really icky.
That's right.
No,
there's a lot of people.
The beach is dirty. The water's dirty.
And the beach is dirty. I would talk to people out there that are leaving their trash and say, "Hey, you left your trash center." Say, "What's it to you?" You know.
People are body to body. You can't get in. And when the boardwalk was first built, it was nice to walk on it the first few times. But now
there, on the other side now, Jennifer, these people that are putting on the lights and are contributing to the boardwalk and everything else are the very same people that would do anything and everything for better schools and better education. There are always givers for the community. And the city fathers that are in the administration know that. We knew that when we built the phone.
Yeah.
We went to Foster Poe, went to people and said, we have somebody that's going to give a whole carload of pipe to build this fountain. They said, they are. And they said, yeah. How would you like to contribute a little bit of money for all of the lights for it? And they said, well, if they're going to give money for a whole carload of pipe, I guess we can give the money for the lights. And he said, fine. And then he went back to the other people and says, they're going to give a whole bunch of money for the lights. How about you giving us money for a carload of pipe? And they said, well, if they're going to give... And that's the way the story went. And that's how we got the fountain built. But Buzz Terrell, R.V. Terrell, over there, was the city manager. And the boys answered to him. I mean, talking about five fellows in one force and everything else, the parks department or something, anybody that worked for the city. I worked for the city one summer. And if I had a problem, I would go up there and I'd say, Mrs. Van, I'd like to see Buzz. She says, he's in there, go on in.
Wow.
And I would go in there and talk to him. That's my, 45, 30 minutes. I don't know if I'm even recording. Turn that thing off and on.
How long did it take for the fountain to get built?
Well, I think we dedicated that fountain in 1964, but it was before that. Boy, is this an opportunity to get something straightened out. And I'm going to break a long-time promise. Tucson, this is during World War I, was, according to all the reports so far that I've read, this is very good. He saw the fountain when he was overseas, and he came back. And he came and he talked to Bill Booth, who was in his tennis chair one time. Well, Bill Booth happened to be my boss in the engineering laboratory at Gardner, Denver. At that time, it was Keller Tool. Okay. He asked me to come on the committee. Bill Booth did. Asked me to, because Tucson had talked to Bill. And when I went up there in the city hall and we started talking about that fountain, there was a few lines on a piece of paper. Okay, this is a conception of what it would be. And so this man says, I designed the fountain. And this is where everybody that was on the fountain, and there were many, there was, you can find this out in your historical records over there in the museum. They were all there. All the names are down there, the original. And a few of them that are there that didn't contribute. One of them, Tom Fullerton, came to one meeting and left. And VP Sims was the head of the Board of Public Light Works. He came to a couple of meetings. He could contribute nothing to it. So anyway, anytime anybody talked about the phone, everybody backed off and said, well, there are a whole lot of people. There were 13 of us that actually did all of the design work and the hands-on building and everything else. And so I don't want to be singled out to give you an interview. I don't want to be singled out to say that I did this on the fountain. You understand how that goes?
Yeah.
Sure. Except for one fellow, and that was Bill Booth. And all I have seen in the past 5 years are some people that pick up stuff out of the Tribune, files about Bill Booth, or maybe we can't find out. None of us can find out how in the he does get his name in the paper with all of this self-glory. And nobody wants to say anything. I've talked to Doc Cresson. We talk quite regularly. And he says, well, I don't want to say anything about it. I don't know anything about it. Well, you know that he does.
Yeah.
You know that people have come up to him and talked to him. And he says, well, if you really want to talk or know anything about it, go see Bill Booth. Well, boy, then they're stuck. Then it's all Bill Booth. And I don't understand why the man wants to continue with this type of thing, because he's just 2 years younger than I am. He's not in business. He might be doing a little consulting yet, so do I. But it isn't all that great. You don't need that that self-image. So that's the way it goes. We talked. At one time we were going to put the fountain on a bar. No, that was Tom Fullerton's idea. That's why he left. He wanted to put the fountain on a barge at the foot of the thing, and the bunch of pipes and everything else, pump the water out of the river and display the thing with the lights. He did not say how he was going to get power to the lights. And we finally, after Tom had left, Press Bills was there. We were talking gallons of water and height and everything else. Finally went across the river and put up balloons on a string and stood on this side of Washington Street and said, well, that's about how high it could be. And then we worried about sound. The lights are going up and down and showing, but sound travels at 88 feet a second in a warm day. We'll see the lights, and in a few seconds, part of a second later, here comes the sound. Well, that isn't any good. Well, maybe we better figure out how to do that. And then we had a fellow saying, well, you can't pump 3,300 gallons through these three pumps without the... You know what happens to a bathtub when the water is running down the hole? You're trying to recirculate that water. It'll cavitate, and if you have this type of a pump and you get air in the system, the pumps will blow up. Well, how are we going to handle that? Well, the first thing to do is get something off the ground. So we went down to Welded Products, took a piece of pipe that was 2.5-inch diameter pipe, and they bent that pipe with torches and a thing, and they bent it around, and then we drilled holes in the top of it and put nozzles in it. We went over onto the cold, where the coal docks were there. We finagled Buzz Terrell did. He said, I'd like to have a pumper down there. I want them to run a test. I want to see how much water that the pumper is capable of. Make sure that it's operating all right. I hooked the pumper up to that thing, and sure, water went up in great shape, and about that time we could figure out how much water it was using. And that was in 1963. And do you know, we started over there, we got a bulldozer on top of the hill. Oh, and just at the last minute, the guy that had part of the North Shore Marina, who had given it to us, said, no, he was going to give it to us for $5,000 or $6,000, sell it to us, and we would raise that money. And he said, no, I don't think I want to do that now. I know that you've got a big project going over there. And this is the owner of the North Shore Marina.
Oh,
so how much do you really want? Well, I'll take $20,000 for it, which was a lot of money in 1963 in there. And Paul Johnson of the Lauder Foundation said, we will buy that and give it to the city of Grand Haven for $20,000. So, Buzz Terrell did all the engineering over there. And I mean drawings of foundations for the building. We're talking about concrete, 4 wide, 3 high, and got all the contractors over there. They laid a bulldoze of that little dip where the fountain is now was the side of a hill, kind of a little swale. But they did dig that all out and make it flat. We were worried about sand coming down into the thing from the overblow. So we had that beach grass all up and down there. Then they asked me to do the pump house, and I designed that building. Then Press Bills and his boy laid out all of that piping that's laying on that cement pad out there. Then we had conceived the valves and things inside. And Press Bills said, I'm not about to touch that inside unless I get some drawings. Then it fell to my lot to design the hydraulic valves and the pneumatic valves and how they would be spaced and how they would be connected to the pipes inside of the building. Long about that time, because of the control valves being operated by air, Doc said, Glenn, you're working at Gardner Denver. Why don't you go see Vince and ask him whether or not we can have a compressor? And I went down and I thought about that for a while. Finally got an interview to he was the president, you know, the big boss of Erickson. So I went to, got it, and said, Mr. Erickson, we would like very much to have a compressor for the phone. He says, all right, how big? I didn't know how big. So I said, I'll be back. He said, next time come prepared. So I went back to my desk and figured. I talked it over with my boss, Bill Booth, and I talked it over with a fellow that was in sales. Went up and said, we need a 10-horsepower compressor. I said, okay, how soon do you need it? I said, well, whenever you can get it. So I'll have it for you next week. And here came a truck from down in Quincy, Illinois, because they made the compressors down there, and brought it up to the phone. And in those days, you're able to say, well, I'm going to sign out. And you just sign out. Well, when Doc called, when the truck arrived at Gardner Denver, I said, you might just as well take it up to the fountain site. And I called Doc Creese on right away. We went to the fountain site. Well, nothing would do. As soon as he got it off the truck, he wanted to take it down the steps and put it in the pump house. We got it in the pump house. He wanted to take it out of the crate and set it up there. I said, we can't do that with just two of us. He says, yeah, we can. And by golly, by tipping and twisting and switching that around, he took that thing out and set it. You never saw a man with such dedication and such, I know it can be done. That was his whole attitude. So, having had the design all fixed and Bill's had, Press had done his job and put the pipes all in and everything else, we had a work bee and they painted all the pipes. And then we started with the wiring. Well, we had decided that it would be an IBM system and that the IBM system would then be put on a Friedan tape. And in those days, the Friedan tapes wouldn't take whatever you had to do. So you would punch in some numbers and punch the punch. Then back up to where you were, punch in different numbers and punch the punch again. So you get more numbers in one space as you're going along. Then we had the tapes for the Friedan. They were the little punch tapes with all the little holes in them. And then we were doing the wiring. And we worked after work, nights. Oh, boy. Until it was cold, I know. We worked after the house was up. We worked miles. Oh, yes. Nobody was paid. And then Buzz Gerald said, I know where there's some pumps, and they were down in the junkyard. The city of Grand Haven had just picked up some new pumps, and they had sold the other one to Padnos. Well, it wasn't Padnos either. It was Jerry Weaver's down there. So we went down and got those pumps, and then they took them down to Gardner Denver, and they rebuilt them, welded them, brazed them all up, fixed them up like they were new, and put them up there. See, the 3,300 volts of electricity. There isn't, well, you've got all the facts, and I don't have to bore you with those, how many gallons a minute it does, and how it can light up a city the size of Harrisburg. 100 bathtubs full of water. And 1964 is when we dedicated that thing. But before we turned that on...
When did you actually start the
project? I think it was late 62.
Okay.
I am not sure of that figure, Jennifer. I'm just not sure of it. But we had the whole gang, well, the working crew, Bill's and everybody else was over there, and it was at night, and we first turned on one set of lights and then another one, and the first thing we did was start blowing fuses, because there was so much power, that in ordinary fuses, and then the relays, we had Alan Bradley relays, they would start arcing and burning out. Because of all the lights that we had. And we had 3,300 volts over there, but which broke down to 110 in lots of places. And we had fun finding the lights. We finally found some lights for $1 a piece that came out of World War II B-25 bombers, landing lights.
Oh, my gosh.
And they were 12 volt, and we had 110 volts, so we strung them all in series. Well, if one blew, then like Christmas tree lights, they all. And that was no. And before we got done, in fact, is I think the last lights we bought were $10 a piece, and I don't think we can get any more. And then we started going to quartz lights. So that night it was over there, and we turned that thing on, and it worked. Boy,
but you just everybody.
Yeah.
Did you guys go out and celebrate after
yeah.
that?
Yeah,
what a feeling to do something that big.
Yeah, that was good. Well, so the fountain went on, and then, of course, the Laudit Foundation kept busy and started working across the river, and they put in all of the... I give them a lot of credit for that. Excuse me. So that was quite an emotional thing. So I'm going to go put myself in the Kleenex here. Is it going?
Yeah.
Yeah. Before I got all shook up over that thing working.
Talking about how that guy got kicked in.
Yeah. You see...
What was his
Cresson, name? Well, that's Dr. Cresson, Bill Cresson, the dentist. And at that time, he was mayor. We had a real good thing going. Mayor, and we had the... And Buzz Terrell was city manager... And we had the crew from Gardner Denver, it became then, and the backing of Gardner Denver, the rides.
Oh, wow.
During the time the phone was on.
Huh.
That's how important it was.
Like a reference.
Yeah. And, well, detracted from the fountain and the people that wanted to see it. That's the way it went. Well, that's pretty well the way the fountain went. And the crew has all died off. Foster's gone. Press Bills is gone. I guess Bill Booth is probably one of the... And Marshall White, who was the electronic genius of this thing, deciding with his help how the programs... We all knew we had to have a tape, and it had to have two channels that were high fidelity channels. And we then tried to decide how on that those two channels of music, how we would be able to get the fountain to chorus relate to the moods of the music. And so we decided that we would put on that third channel a voice count, and the voice count would be as long as the program. And what we did with the voice count was we made a tape that counted from 1 to 100. And we played it and kept on repeating it until we had a tape that we could just put right on with the whole music tape, and it would count 100, and then 200, and then 300, 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, that count was at slow speed. It was at... If you played it at the regular speed, it sounded like Mickey Mouse. You know, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Well, we used that count then, and on the fourth channel of that tape, we would put pulses. One pulse, or two pulses, or three pulses, and every pulse said, Frieden tape, move once. Or if it had four pulses on it, the Frieden tape would jump four spaces, thump, 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 thump. And we could get up to six spaces a second. Well, then the Frieden tape, which jumped, had its holes punched in it, and all of those holes had little fingers, and the fingers would make contact with electrical relays, and the relays would be what the fountain would do.
Oh.
The relays closing electrically would close and open pneumatic valves, or the electric valves, the electric relays for the lights, and so we would play the tape back and forth on this thing right here, this recorder, and play it back and forth, and write down what we wanted the fountain to do by code numbers. And then Bernie Boink would go over there and he would listen to, he would have our choreographic sheet. And he had a console in front of him that had six buttons on it. And if we had three things down there at voice, he was listening to the voice call. 123, 124, 124, 23, 24, 25, 26. And he would be punching that thing, three pulses, five pulses, one pulse, four pulses, for the whole length of the program. See? And then the pulses were on that fourth channel. And that's how the thing was synchronized. How much more we talk about the phone? I think we ought to get off of that thing for a while.
I just wanted to go back. You were talking about how you did the newspaper route and stuff. I was just wondering, how much did you pay for that, to do the newspaper route?
I think it was... We collected and we got a percentage of it. We had to pay for our papers. Jennifer, I don't remember. All I know is that I would be making maybe $5, $6 a week, so long as everybody was paying good. And those people down there in that, what we call, well, I guess it's a pretty nice area now. The marina and everything else is down there. But at one time, those people would give me my pay. They would pay for their paper sometimes in pennies.
Oh.
Yeah. And when you'd go up on the other end of town, up on Lake Avenue, they were never home. My husband will pay you. And that's where I had the bad time. The people that bought the Wall Street Journals and things. The downtown business people were very good. To answer your question, how much did they pay? I guess I used to save 50-cent pieces. And I would put them in my room up on Clinton Street there.
Wow.
I would judge with all three routes that I would probably make around $20 a week.
Wow, that's very good.
Yeah, but it's a misnomer. I'm sure that the figure is way too high. Don't remember.
Someone was telling me one of the other people I interviewed worked at Brock's Bakery for like $15 a week, and that was after she graduated.
Hey, when I was in the last year of high school, I gave up the bakery and things because my mark. I was trying to graduate high school, and I worked for the Robin Hood Theater. And you don't remember or even know where the Robin Hood Theater was. There were three theaters. There was the Grand Theater, which is still there. There was the Robin Hood Theater, which is where the Old Kent Bank is now.
Oh, my gosh. Three theaters, wow.
And the Crescent Theater, which, do you know where... the Prince Heating Company used to be in there. Okay, the best way to describe it is to go down to Ferry and Washington. And again, if Washington runs north and south, it was on the south east corner. It's a big brick building there that has the front. The bicycle shop is in there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I can't think of him. He worked at Garden. He's my good friend. Can't think of him. Runs a bicycle shop. And also the back of it is now used for Beckens storage. And that was a huge theater. That's where my one and only thing I can remember was one time I went down there and there was dish night, and I won a set of dishes. And I had to set them down, I think, about 12 times before I got them home, walking home. So.
What did your mom think?
Oh, she was just delighted. Yeah, that in those days everything was fried and things. And Jennifer, in those days they used to have ice cream wars. Well, you know where Washington? Oh, I told you. What did I tell you? What was it? Oh, Box Bakery. There, right across the street where they're remodeling all of this things in there, there was a drugstore. Presley's drugstore was in there, and our favorite thing. I had a friend, Schaefer. He's dead now. And I would pick him up because his house was right where Beckins Appliance Store is now. I would pick him up there. We would go down to the Crescent Theater, watch the movie. I think it cost us 15 cents. And then we would come back, and we would get a pint of ice cream and some topping. And we would sit there and eat our pint of ice cream with the ice cream wars of Presley's. I think it was McDonald's that had the price wars. And there was, and walk. You walked everywhere. I had a bicycle once, and I rode it down to the Grand Theater, and a young fella stole that. I know who it was. We knew who it was.
Wow.
But my dad wouldn't say, yeah, he's still living. He's still here in town.
He stole it.
That's it. Yeah, well, there was a nice bicycle there, and he didn't lock anything, and he rode it away.
I think in a town... The small, everybody knew
in those days, yeah. Yeah.
It would be really hard.
Well, they found him right away. I mean, his mother, I think, was the one that turned him, said, my son's got a bicycle. Do you know if anybody has lost one or something?
Well, did he get the bike back?
Yeah, he got the bike back. But and the fellow went on. He's was quite well-liked and had a nice job in a very good position here in town. That's enough of that one.
During the Depression, you said that you nailed a carpet off the parlor?
Yeah. That particular house, as you're going in, it had a front porch, which we screened in, with the exception of the very right-hand end of it, which we walked up to that porch and into the doors. And as soon as you got in the doors, there was a steps that went upstairs. And that was to two bedrooms upstairs. Well, then, of course, alongside of the hallway, there's the steps, there's a hallway. And in the middle of the hallway, if you went to the left, you entered what we called the living room. And if you went on down the hallway, you would enter into a dining room, which was the full width, no, not quite the full width of the house. It was a full width, and then if you went on past that, you would go into the kitchen, and then the left end of that was the bathroom. Well, going down halfway through the hallway and turning to the left and going into the living room, if you kept on walking, you would enter a room that would be roughly the size of half of this rec room here. And it was in there, we had the piano, and in those days, nothing, no television. A radio that my dad had an antenna strung between the house and the barn so that you could pick up Walter Cronkite and the Joe Louis fights and things like that. And we would listen to Father Coughlin because he was a very controversial figure at that time. And in that parlor was a large settee or a couch. We also had one in the living room where and my daddy's big chair with a wing bags, you know, and another rocking chair for my mother. But in that parlor, and there was a piano just about the size of that one, a big Baldwin upright piano. And my sister played the piano. She learned from the Catholic. And my mother played the piano. And all our relatives would come from Grand Rapids, and they would sit around there, and we would drink my father's beer that he had made. They would drink that. And either, or they had been going fishing in the morning, they were all at the pier, and they come back with a whole mess of these perch. The women would be cleaning the perch, and then they all come in and sing. The guys sitting around drinking beer and sing songs on the piano. And then they would all go back. See, my daddy came from Grand Rapids, yeah. And he was one of 13.
Wow.
Right? One of 13. And the ones that were left that didn't move way out of town and things would come in to the pier and go fishing. Jennifer, at one time in my youth, I remember spending a whole week on the North Shore in a tent. That was the first place I learned to drink coffee. There was a Coast Guard station there, and that was it. There were no houses there. We put up a tent, and it had another piece of canvas over it they called a fly to keep it on. And my mother and I stayed in that tent for a week, and my dad would come out with Laudit's car. He would drive out there. And we stayed there. We played on the beach and slept in that tent. And, okay, 15 yards, no. I would say 60 feet from the pier is where the tent was. And back up on the beach there. We had a good... That's the first place that I learned to drink coffee because we were in it.
Were you an only child?
No, I had a sister.
Oh, that's right, sister.
Yep, and she died when I was 11 years old. She went to high school, and she was a good friend of Carl Olson's. They all ran down to the Grand Theater because the Saugatuck Festival was putting on a Blossom Queen contest, the forerunner of Miss Michigan contest. And when she came back, it was raining and she had caught cold. And in those days, they didn't have penicillin. They didn't have... I turned over. I guess that isn't important. They didn't have penicillin or sulfur or anything else. And she contracted streptococcus throat. And it went into spinal meningitis and she was dead in 17 days. So, yeah, she died in the house, and the funeral was, and she stayed in the house. She stayed in the house until they even brought in chairs. They had the funeral, the service in the house. The funeral guy come in and checked the house to make sure that the joists and the things would hold up the people that came. Not too many people came. Most of them were stood outside. Windows are open. And they read the service, and then they went to the cemetery. And then, because you had no insurance or anything else, we were worried about the funeral. And Mr. Lauder came and said, I'll take care of it. So he paid for it.
That was yeah. Depression.
Yep.
No, I never got straight why you nailed that carpet up, though. I still want to find that out.
Well, mostly it was impression. But you see, in those days, we heated the house with a coal heater that was in that living room, or in the it was in the dining room. As I told you, the dining room went through, was the full width of the house, and the kitchen was beyond that. Well, at the left end of the dining room was my folks' bedroom. That was the downstairs bedroom, and it was tied right in with the parlor, with a wall between. Well, when you heat the house, we had registers in the ceiling that opened up and the heat could go upstairs. But the house was heated with a 3-foot square stove that sat right in between, right alongside the door to the bedroom from that dining room. And the chimney came up on the top and went right straight into the wall into another chimney. And so we closed that off so that we wouldn't have to burn so much coal.
Oh.
The coal truck would come, and my mother would close all the doors, and she would hang a carpet over the door of the coal bin, and just be beside herself, because when they put the coal down into the chute, the dust came up everywhere. Coal dust. And she would be beside herself. And coal, I remember getting to, my dad saying, my God, coal is expensive. We got 12 ton of coal, and it would cost him about $50, I think.
Wow. Wow.
And that was a lot of money, you know.
Yeah.
It was, boy, that's
he was
a whole
week. $35.
And that would last. I'm sorry?
He was getting paid $35 a week.
Yeah, $35
a week. 3 weeks. Yeah. Wow.
But in that time, he bought that house next door, the Denhurst house. And later on, of course, he sold it.
He had a
steady income. Steady income. So where do we go from here, Jennifer? I'm kind of wandering around. I'm sure you're not getting enough.
Oh, there's a few things I want to straighten up. Okay, we can go into industry.
Well, that was Gardner Denver. First I went from high school. I went to junior college in Muskegon, mm-hmm. and that's when it was in the old building. There's a nice modern educational plant outside of town now, outside the other side of the highway. But the one that I went to was that old Hackley building across from the Hackley Library. And then from there, after 2 years, I went to Ann Arbor, the University of Michigan. And it was there that the war picked me up. And after the war, I came back and finished it. I started out as an aeronautical engineer. And because of that, I went into the Air Force when they took me. And I went in the Air Force. I wanted to go to Officers Candidate School. I applied for that. First, I was teaching link trainers how to teach people how to fly a plane blind while they're on the ground. And then I signed up. I wanted to go to parachute school, weather school, because that was in Grand Rapids. And I was in Illinois at the time. But I didn't get it. That was my first choice. My second choice was field artillery. And so I wound up in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, that's where I got a second lieutenant. And that's where I served in the war as a second lieutenant up until just about leaving and got first lieutenant. But anyway, I went back to school, and I was at finished school. Then I was working for Eastern Airlines, and I was also in the laboratory, the engineering laboratory at school, doing research work for the first metals that were being used for the turbine blades of the jet engines. That's when jet engines were first being started, and they had these high stress metal. And I was running horsepower, cutting speeds, and everything else for that in the lab, and getting paid for it, and working in Eastern Airlines in an apartment, and studying, taking courses. Well, then my father died, and I came back to Grand Haven. Now what? I got lost.
You're talking about industry.
Went to work then for Keller, several places. I bounced around in Grand Haven two or three places before I landed at Keller Tool. In fact, I was working for Van's Island Lumber Company. And I delivered lumber. Yep. That's right where Myers is now. And I delivered a load to Keller Tool at the time. And I asked Jim Brown, do they have any openings? He says, say, boy, you look pretty good to me. I'll tell you what, you come on, I'll talk to the boss, and I'll call you up. And he did. He called me at home. And I went over there, and I went up and interviewed McNaughton on December, whatever. And it was December 28th or something. And he said, I want you to come to work for me. He said, you can start in the engineering laboratory. We're just starting it up, the test lab. And I started to work on January 2nd, the very next, right after that weekend. Started to work there. And that was in 1951. And I went up from the test lab, test engineer, senior test engineer, and then they were developing some things, and I went into design development. And design development is where I got my three patents. I was working on that. And I got patents for impact wrenches, clutch mechanisms, and for this trolley that runs like your electric trolley that takes, like the streetcars used to run off of a wire. Well, this thing ran down. It took air out of a tube.
It was a thing. This was at Gardner Denver?
And then it became Gardner Denver bought them out.
It was Keller.
It was first Keller's, yeah. But it was Gardner Denver that, well, some place in the transition there. And, of course, being in the lab and being close to these things, a lot of the new stuff was made in the laboratory by some model makers that we had in there also. We had some machines in there, and we had test booths and labs and equipment, and we would make our own test fixtures and things to test the tools. And the new tools that were designed were first made in, maybe two or three of them were made, and they were made in that lab, and we would test them. Well, be doing that, well, then if the new tools were going to be shown on the market, who would know better than to go over to the Pantland Hotel in Grand Rapids and help set up the show and get the booths and things ready? So we did some of that. And if things, new products went out in the field, became troublesome in the field, we would fly out to California or wherever it was and help the salespeople understand what had gone wrong and how to fix it and things. We did a lot of training in that. So then it became Cooper, and I gave up on the design development thing, and I became a product engineer. I had 5 products for which I was responsible for making sure that they were made right and that they didn't cost too much, keep the cost down, and that they were sold right and that everything that went out was good enough. And about that time is when Susie said, "This place is folding up." And that was 1982. And they, in fact, had called me and said, "Glenn, would you like to take early retirement?" And I said, "No, I'm going to be 62 next year. I have about 7 months to go, and then I'll bow out." And they said, "That's all right with us. If you have that short time, we won't. But otherwise, your job is eliminated." And I said, "Well, thank you very much." Jennifer, in those days, probably still is, you're in the office, there's no union, and they eliminate your job, all of the time that you've put in there, maybe you put in 29 years, and you've built up what you hope would be a very nice retirement fund, they'll give you a cash settlement and you're done. Now you don't get anything from then on. You see, I'm still receiving a pension from Gardner Denver. But the most important thing, I am getting all of my hospitalization paid. And that's a big chunk.
Yes.
You know, anytime you have anything wrong, go to the doctor and the hospital or anything else, paid for it.
That's true.
Yep, that's a big chunk. And if they eliminate your job, you're done. So that was my 30 years to the day. And I was 62. I had put in 30 years on January 2nd of 1982. And on July the 6th, 1982, I was 62 years age. And I said, "I'll see you." And the following fall, they began closing down their doors. And that's when Sue left. And she's getting a pension also. That's as much as I have in the industry. I have worked at
the cellar industry still, because I was totally unaware that.
Oh, they used to get a quarter an hour. Oh, I was going to tell you, I worked at the Robin Hood Theater.
Oh, yeah.
I worked for a quarter an hour there.
Oh.
I was the manager. I was the usher.
Okay.
I was the whole thing.
You got a quarter an hour.
Yep.
Is that pretty good pay?
Oh, boy. That was good pay in those days, yeah. Yep, and that Robin Hood Theater was condemned, and then the state bank bought it, and then, what is it now?
Is it
old? It's Old Kent. Darn, there was. There's three names. Yeah, the doctor's officer and officer. Can't figure what it was. I've forgotten what three names that doggone old Kent had before. See, Mr. Laudert was director of that. And that's another place he made his money. When the banks closed, he had all of it. He knew about it. In fact, he told my dad, take your savings out of there. So he did. And he was also instrumental in me working at Keller Tool one summer in between from the University of Michigan on second shift, because he owned 51% of Keller Tool.
Oh, my gosh.
And I don't know how much
of it. Impact on your life?
Yeah, yeah.
He seemed to be a very nice man.
He was a huge man. He stood about 6 foot tall. He must have gone about 250 pounds.
Holy.
And a real financier. He would walk into a place and, boy, everybody would stop and look. You know, he just stood there and he would look around. He would do that at Keller Tool. He would walk up in there and they'd say, "How do you do, Mr. Lauder? How do you do, Mr. Lauder?" He'd walk. And he smoked a cigar, you know. He was a typical tycoon. Do you know what that word is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. One time we had a fellow by the name of Boomgard. Now, the Boomgards are still around town. But this fellow was their father, Jim Boomgard. And he was the plant manager at Keller Tool. And when Vint Erickson first came to town, oh, by the way, Johnson Jacobson, the JSJ, before they were JSJ, also had some interests in Gardner-Denver. Keller Tool. They thought that they could do a little bit better by having in a fellow that would be a real hotshot, and they called in Vince Erickson, special from New York, who they had educated. And he came in, and the first thing he said, "Well, I don't think that we can do what with the old school. We'll have to get in the new blood right away. I'll hire somebody, but in the meantime, I think I'll get rid of you, Jim. Nothing wrong, but you're just the old school, and we have to start fresh here." Well, Mr. Lauder used to walk into the place and say, "Hi, Jim, how are things going? How's fishing and everything else?" And they'd talk a bit. Then he'd go on upstairs and parade down all through the business section of the thing, and everybody would say, "Mr. Lauder," you know, and he'd walk into the office. Well, he walked into Vince's office, and he said, "Where's Jim Boomgard?" And Vince says, "Well, I got rid of him." He said, "Get him back." "Well, he's the old school." "Well, I don't care. I like Jim. He's a nice guy. I think he's been doing a good job. I like the bottom margin on the profit sheet here. Get him back." "Well, I don't think I want to do that, Mr. Lauder." He said, "Well, if you don't want to do that, you're done."
Oh, my God.
He said, "Okay, I'll get him back." He says, "And get him back by tomorrow night. I want him in here by tomorrow night." Well, Ben called the house. Jim wasn't there. He's out fishing. Ben went and got a rowboat and rowed out to Jim. Jim says, "Go jump. I'm not coming back there." And Vint was beside himself, and I don't know how it all came about, but Jim came back. And Vince, they kept his job, and Mr. Lauder was happy.
A bit of a
I don't know what happened. And Jim Boomgard stayed there until he retired. Well, I was still there. That's a little bit of industry. The politics in industry is terrific. And if you go into industry, you had better well have not just a Bachelor of Science of anything. You'd better go on and get that doctor's degree.
Yeah.
Yep.
It
is. And I would stay out of industry.
Me too.
In industry today, there are no ethics. There are people that decide that they will buy this place with junk bonds and get this done and that. And when they get it done, some one of those outfits, those little entities, are gone, and all the people with them, they're gone, and that's not fair.
Mm-hmm. Industry, it's just too, like
you
said, just too much for the dollar. And
when I left, I was in a meeting, just before I left, And I heard the not sales manager, engineering manager, the engineering manager, his name is Yudeni, speak of units. And I asked him, what are you talking about units? He said, well, I figure that if we have this amount of production go through here and then we can do this, that we could probably save ourselves 14 or 15 units during this 30-day period. I said, what are units? He said, people.
Oh, my gosh.
About that time, I knew it was time to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, what do we talk about next?
I still want to find out about the celery fields. Where did they...
You come back to about another
time. Where did they send their stuff?
Oh, it was all sent to Chicago.
Chicago. Yep.
As soon as it was harvested, they would... all went into these crates, like your strawberry things, you know. All went into the crates, and they would drive all night and hit the celery markets in the morning in Chicago. And just hope and pray that the price was right. Because they would have three or four trucks unload their whole harvest.
Wow.
Sure. Talking about a field that was maybe four to six city lots. And the celery industry, do you know how to do the celery? They go along, and in those days, without machinery or anything else, you went along and you just had your back bent, and you had a little bag of celery plants, and you would put them in and pat them, put the next one in, pat it. They were about this far apart, and you stayed bent until you got the whole end of the line, and the lines were about 2 feet apart. Okay. Then as soon as they came up and they started to get going pretty good, they would keep the dirt mounded on the sides of them. This is for the white stalks.
Yeah.
And as soon as they couldn't do that anymore, they had old boards. Now, those boards were first used when they started in there to walk on because it was muck. Mud. You couldn't walk it. And the kids would come back from work after working all day, and they could hardly walk. They were so tired, and they were just mud. And that's why my dad said, I don't think you can handle it. But then, after that so long, then they would put the boards up against and put the mud up against the side. Now, when they got up to there, and they would keep checking, and they would say, oh, boy, well, I think we're one of the first. And the first ones to get their celery cut and hit that Chicago market got the best price. And they would load that, and they would work... all day long, and the trucks would take off with their whole crop, and away they'd go. So they all went to Chicago.
Okay, now we can move on to something else.
Finally got the doggone celery out of the way.
Find out that little tidbit information. The neighborhoods, were there designated neighborhoods in Grand Haven?
Designated neighborhoods?
Well, I mean,
in a way.
I've heard about the East End.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure where it is and why it was the East End. What was so special that it got its own name?
It's just a shopping center now. They call it Central, and they call it East End or whatever. People didn't use cars as much as they do now. If you got any place, you walked. So I guess the town was kind of divided up.
Into the neighborhood.
Yeah, you would call it, East End of town. I don't know why. Why would you call it East End? What do you call Central Business District now, don't you?
You mean
Center Town? That's what you call it, Center Town. What do you call out on? I've forgotten the name of that street again. What street is the tannery on? Beach Street. What do you call that area, those businesses that are out there along Beach Street? They've all had one hassle about that a little while ago, and finally Deason decided that he would improve their lot out there. Pave the streets, things, pay a little more attention to the businesses that are developing out there, because they said, hey, we're part of the city too. We're kind of out here in the sticks. kind out here in the East End.
There you go.
But I don't know why. People decide that there's two stores there. I think this would be a good place to locate alongside of them, because those two stores would attract business for us. I don't know what else.
Okay. How about Native Americans? Do you remember?
There again, I was thinking of the Robins and the Hattons and the rest of those.
Okay. Native, not Indian Native.
Oh, no, I didn't know of any Indians or Natives. I was just thinking of the first people, and we went through that a little bit, Jennifer. Yeah, the first ones. Because I remember the streets that weren't paved. I remember the car ferries we used to go down and watch the car. I caught heck so many times for going down and watching the trains switch the cars back and forth to load them on the car ferries. And I caught heck for walking down by the river alone, because the tugs, there was good fishing. And the tugs used to come in, and they would just dock against these flimsy little bunch of poles and a couple of boards laid on them, just to unload the fish onto the shore. And we would go down there and walk. I learned to swim in Grand River.
In the river?
In Grand River, yeah.
You wouldn't want to swim in it now.
No, but at that time we could. I almost drowned trying to swim across Grand River, because a bunch went across and I was about the youngest one of them to go across. And where we landed, when we swam across, was where the North Shore Marina is right now. There wasn't docks, there wasn't anything. There was just a little cove in the river, and with a sand beach. That's all that was there. Do you know that when my dad and I wanted to go fishing on the North Pier, that we would walk to the South Pier, out across from where the Coast Guard station was, and there was a ring in the cement of the thing, and my dad would pick that up and bang it, pick it up and bang it, and it would ring in the cement. Pretty soon somebody would come out of the Coast Guard station and he'd say, "Hey, how about a ride and the fellow would say, "Okay," and he'd go down there to where the Coast Guard station slip is, and there was a rowboat there, and he would row across the river and give us a ride across, and we would walk on the North Pier and go fishing. He did that a couple of times that I remember. Now, I think they can't do it because of insurance or something.
Yeah.
Or whatever. But
what
you
fishing?
See...
Fishing seems to be quite a big...
Recreation. Perch. Oh, boy. I can remember going out, not early morning. We would go out there before breakfast. I would say around 6 o'clock. Now they go out when it's just dawn is breaking, you know. I never did get used to that. You go out there and fish on the lakeside. You'd use minnows, you had cane poles, and they used to say that 50 perch was the limit. 50. And the perch were about 7-8 inches long. And if you ran out of minnows, well, then you'd use cut bait, you know, and things. But the gang would come from Grand Rapids, or my dad and mother and myself would go out. I don't remember my sister at all. We'd go out there and go fishing and come home and clean them. Oh, boy.
Yes. Do you have cats?
No, I don't know what they did to the offal. Mm-hmm. But you would have the perch fries. In those days, all you had was an icebox. And it was a great thing. Then my dad decided to tear the old shed off of the back of the house, and he put a new little, I guess it was a shed also. But the old shed was for horses. It was attached to the back of the house. It had a steep front of it and a sloping back, and inside of it were all stalls. It went from the house almost three quarters of the way back. Oh, and then in the back of the thing was a great big barn that was eventually torn down. Well, we used to drive the car and park in that little park, go up the little ramp and park in the barn there. That's right in the middle of the city. So we tore the shed down, and he built another little one on there, and also, which was be a better way, instead of going outside, we could now go down and into the basement, down around the corner, and go outside there. And that then is where the ice box was put. And that then is where he decided to drill a hole in the floor and take a tube and put it up into the pan, the drip pan for the ice, and then we didn't have to empty the ice pan anymore. My mother would scream, the pan is running over, you know. And you have to go there and pull that pan out and a little ways and scoop the water out of it from where the ice had melted, and then take the pan and throw it out the back door, the pan of water. But no more of that, except once in a while the thing would get clogged up. Remember the Iceman coming to put 50 pounds of ice in there like nobody's business? Take his, I don't know, 20 cents or what it was on that? And away he'd go. And there was a lot of jokes about the Iceman, you know, coming to the gals' doors and things. The Iceman cometh.
Almost as bad as the Milkman, yeah. Huh?
And
was that Silver Plank Iceman?
Yeah, I believe it was, yeah. And then there was a Spring Lake, maybe that was Verplank's, yeah. Spring Lake Ice and Coal. I used to come over one time, I don't know why, but I remember where they stored the ice, and I watched them cut ice in Spring Lake, yes.
From the lake?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm trying to get an interview with one of the
Whitey, I don't know if Whitey's still around or not. I designed Whitey's house.
Oh.
The one that's over there.
I don't think so. The Vernon Verplank and
Jerry
Verplank are both the names that I have.
Yeah.
Whitey
Verplank.
Was he the father?
Had a structural steel buildings place on the other side of where Barrett's is, you know, right along by the where the channel is between Spring Lake and Grand River. And he called me up one night and said, I want to build a house. And I said, well, okay. Well, come on over, take a look. And he showed me about what he had. He said, I got a lot down here in Spring Lake. And he said, well, I'll sketch up something for you. He said, when do you have to have it? He said, tomorrow morning, the bulldozers are coming.
You're kidding me.
I worked till 3 o'clock that night and dropped it off at his place the next morning. I had no idea that he would like it or not, but I came by there at 5 o'clock when I came back that next afternoon. The ground was level and the foundations were in there because that's very low ground. And he had the foundations in. I never heard another word from him. I would design a three-bedroom house. It would take me about 20 hours, and I would get about $20 for it. And now, the last one I did, I charged $100.
Really?
Yeah. There was nothing to stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning designing a house or drawing up a house and taking a whole week or so to do it.
Yeah.
And go to the people, no charge for interview time, none. I have about 130 houses here in the Tri-Cities area that I've designed.
Pretty good.
So, well, that was all pin money. It came and helped to keep the family. I worked. You know, I was married before. I married Susan. And then it was through that purchasing of houses and moving and things like that that you gradually build up your equity. And then when you decide you can't get along together, well, you give the equity away and start over. That's what happened. So. What else?
Okay.
I'm dallying.
Okay. Men's rolls.
The which?
Men's rolls.
You mean from Brock's Bakery? Men's rolls.
Did men have was it more men are men and women are women? Kind of, is that how you were raised? Men do this and women do that?
Very seldom Selma did much of a father. Once in a while we went fishing. I can remember many times when I went astray and he just looked at me and he said, well, live and learn, you've done it once. All is forgiven. Like the time I ran my dad's one-year-old car under the train.
Oh my God.
He asked me, "Are you hurt?" And I said, "No." He said, "Okay, thank the Lord." And that was the last heard of it.
You're kidding. Mm-hmm. How in the world did you get it out of the train?
2 o'clock in the morning, coming back from a date in Muskegon, 1937 Ford. Deluxe Ford. In that time, the old Grand Haven Road was the highway. And that's where you went. I had an interesting experience on that highway, too, out there, that road, I'll tell you. It was a two-lane highway. Coming home, you turned... You know how 7th Street comes into town now?
Yeah.
When you branch off of the highway, 7th Street? That was still there. And the highway would come down, was 7th Street, and right there at Fulton,